The Story Factor Podcast, episode number 2, How to Fix Broken Stories.
Welcome to the Story Factor Podcast with Annette Simmons.
Story is the oldest form of influence in human history.
Annette is the author of The Story Factor, Territorial Games, and Whoever Tells the Best Story Wins.
When you stimulate human emotions with a story, you point those emotions in a certain direction.
Now Annette is here to help you inspire, influence, and persuade through the art of storytelling.
No one will complain if you substitute a story for a PowerPoint slide.
Notice I'm not using PowerPoint and there's no handouts. My goal is that this actually be valuable enough that you remember.
And now your host, she takes painting lessons in a studio in her backyard and has percussion instruments from several dead societies. Here's Annette Simmons.
Hi, this is Annette Simmons, and welcome to the Story Factor Podcast. I believe that no matter who you are or what you do, that becoming a better storyteller will improve your ability to communicate and connect. So before we get started, a quick reminder, these interviews are also going to be on YouTube. They probably aren't quite yet, but they will be. I'm also on Twitter. We could have a conversation that way. And I've posted articles that you could download from my website, AnnetteSimmons.com, that cover some of the things that I talk about in the books about how to go about finding stories and tell stories. I want to hear what your thoughts are about this show. This is the first one. It's an interview with Karen Dietz. And my hope is that this stimulates some questions that you want answered. I'm always hunting for shortcuts that won't sacrifice meaning when we find and tell stories. And any way that might improve our ability to find good stories. So if you have some thoughts about that, if you have some questions or even somebody you'd like to interview, you can leave a message on the Story Factor Podcast feedback line at 318-479-1077. So our guest, as I mentioned this week, is Karen Dietz of JustStoryIt.com. And we talk about how she helps organizations gather stories, find and repair broken stories. This is a concept I hadn't thought about before. She explains broken stories and how those need to be fixed before you can create shared and common understanding. Karen has a PhD in folklore, which gives her some shortcuts on story gathering techniques. So we talk about those as well. Karen, welcome to the Story Factor Podcast.
Hi, Annette, and hi, everyone. Yeah, it's a delight to be here. What a pleasure, Annette, to be chatting with you and sharing whatever we're going to.
Yeah. Karen and I have been talking about story for, 15 years now, maybe?
Yeah, about.
Yeah, so you have a company called Just Story It, right? Mm-hmm. And
yes.
You can find Karen on JustStoryIt.com. Mm-hmm. And she's got some wonderful resources there, so you want to check out that website. Now, you want to tell the story about how we met, or shall I?
Oh, you better tell it.
Well, I remember going to the National Storytelling Festival, and I guess the first one I went to was 1994. When was the first one you went to?
The very first festival was in 1981.
Hoo-wee.
It was the fifth one, I think.
The fifth one. Awesome. Awesome. Wow. You've been a long-time practitioner of storytelling. You beat me by a mile. So then we met at a storytelling festival, or maybe a storytelling conference. The National Storytelling Network has a conference every year, which is just for primarily professional storytellers. Did you ever practice as a professional storyteller?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay, me either. I just learned from them. And then you became executive director.
Yes, of the National Storytelling Network.
Right, right. And I remember that bringing all of these cats into a herd was quite difficult. And you and I began to talk when I was helping you with the organizational development part of it.
Right. I had known of you for many years because of your book, you know, The Story Factor. And I, when I got to meet you in person, I was like a little kid. Oh, I get to meet Annette Simmons. And it was just such a delight. And what I loved about you was just your forthrightness. You know, just, hey, you just lay it out on the line, tell it like it is.
It's not always a good thing, but yeah, that's what I do.
I know, I've learned that too, but I sort of felt like a kindred spirit. And we had some wonderful conversations, as I recall. We've just carried those conversations through over the years, and you have been an immense help to me also.
So tell me about your story from 1981. I guess maybe that was your first exposure. I don't know, but just bring us up to date from then.
Right. Well, academically, I'm a folklorist. I have a PhD in folklore. And when I tell people that, they kind of like go, oh, huh? What's that?
Yeah.
And it, you
what
know,
is
it,
that?
It is, what is that? It's like anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
What folklorists do is study how a culture transmits its knowledge and its values and its wisdom through time, all through creative expression, story, song, dance, art, craft, architecture. And we're anthropologists, we end up, folklorists and anthropologists, we end up, you know, studying a lot of the same things, or arriving at the same place, but our entry points into a system are different.
Like, what are some of the practices that you learned as a folklorist?
Regarding stories, I learned how to collect them, how to catalog them, how to analyze them, how to preserve them, how to document them.
What were some of the ways that you learned how to collect them specifically?
Well, I learned how to ask for stories in a specific way that got stories in return. There are many ways of being in an interview where you can receive from that person lots of information and opinion, but not necessarily a story.
Right.
And since the story is the richest form of communication and conveys much more than an opinion or a piece of information does, then why not go for the gold and just learn to really evoke stories and learn how to work with those stories?
Can you give us a couple of pointers from the folklorist background?
Well, sure. And I think other storytellers would say the same. One of the things you would do is you would use a prompt, a specific prompt for a story, like, tell me about a time when.
Right.
Tell me what happened when.
Yeah.
And now you'll notice a couple things. I didn't say, tell me a story about.
Right. Yeah.
That will get you into trouble.
Yeah.
Because people will then think, oh, you want to hear something made up, or maybe.
Well, and they freak out too. It's like, oh.
I know, I don't know stories. So we stay away from that word story, and we ask the question or evoke the question in such a way that we really want them to relive an experience, not talk about something. That when I work with executives in storytelling skills, that's one of the first things that they do, is they're up there at the 20,000 foot level, yeah, not sharing an experience, but saying, well, you know, this happened, and then that happened, and in the end, it all worked out.
Right.
Instead of saying, you know, I was sitting at my desk one day, and all of a sudden, I got.
And it was 3 o'clock, and yeah.
It was 3 o'clock, and, you know. And so that's really reliving the experience, and that's what we want to evoke when we're working with somebody in stories, or evoking stories from somebody, when we want to hear those stories.
I interrupted you. Let's go back to, you know, you've got this, what'd you get, a PhD in folklore?
I did get a PhD in folklore, and I never cared about stories.
Get out.
I thought that they were the most boring thing to work with.
What did you care about?
Barns.
Sorry, I don't want to blast the microphone.
No, barns. Absolutely. I wanted to study barns. I loved barns. I loved looking at understanding about round barns and square barns and rectangular barns and hay barns and corn barns and tractor barns and German barns and English barns.
Okay, stop.
You know, and I doing all of that cataloging and analyzing of stories and fairy tales, I thought, but here's the other thing that was really kind of turned me off to storytelling, and I find this enormously amusing. But I think being a folklorist is pretty cool. And, you go to parties and people will ask what you do. And I say, well, I'm a folklorist. And they go, oh, you're a storyteller. And I go, no, I may collect stories. I may study stories. I may document stories. I may work with stories. I may preserve stories. But I'm not a storyteller.
I'm going to ask you to finish this sentence, because storytellers are.
Well, that was the next part,
right?
Because this person would say, oh, John, come on over here, you have to meet Karen, she's a storyteller. And John would say, oh, do you tell stories to kids in the library at 3 in the afternoon? And that is a very, very important activity. Very, yes. Very important. But it's not what I went to get a PhD for. So there's all this ambivalence about stories and storytelling, and we think that, oh, it's for kids, it's not for adults. You were, did groundbreaking work in bringing storytelling into business and demonstrating and documenting how powerful it is and how needed it is. And I've just followed in on your coattails there. But what I want to tell you, though, what you did for me, it was so funny, because I moved off into business and working as a consultant in business. Mm-hmm. Never able to tell anybody that I was a folklorist, much less that I was collecting stories in the organization, and this is how I was conducting my research.
Your
and
dirty
finding
little
great
secret.
Information for them. So, because I wanted to work, and no one's going to pay me to do that if I told them that, right? So I just did what I did anyway, and I called myself whatever they needed, But around the year 2000, after your book had been published and Steve Denning's book had been published, all of a sudden I heard among my executives, oh, storytelling, that, pretty cool stuff. I really get it. I think it's important.
And you're like, duh.
So all of a sudden I could come out of the closet.
That's cool.
And I could say, yeah, and oh, by the way, I'm a folklorist, and oh, by the way, I've studied storytelling.
As a matter of fact.
Right. But what changed my mind about storytelling actually happened in graduate school, leads us back to going down to the National Festival, is that one day I was in the archive in the department, and in walked this guy. Turns out he was a Chippewa Cree from up in Saskatchewan, Canada. Mm-hmm. Said, oh, I hear you're a folklorist and you might be interested in what I have to say. Turns out his name was Ron Evans. He was the keeper of the talking sticks for his tribe. He held all the sacred stories.
Wow.
And he started to sit down and share these stories with us, and my mouth just dropped open. I mean, I was stunned by their power and their beauty. So for the next 3 years, every time Ron would come in and out of Philadelphia, where I was going to school, he had a nomadic existence. He was kind of a nomad at that time. Whenever he'd come in, I'd say, oh, Ron, let's have a storytelling evening or weekend. And I would gather a group of people together, and we'd sit and listen to him. And he would just sit and share stories with us. Mm. Now, imagine this. Somebody is telling stories from Friday night until Sunday at 6 o'clock. And by the time 6 o'clock rolls around, he's done.
Right, right.
But what I noticed about us listening is that we could have sat there for another 2 weeks and still not felt fully fed.
Wow.
That is how hungry we were for stories. Well, that was a real eye-opener. And I really experienced firsthand how storytelling can be so powerful.
For lack of a better word, as a consumer.
Right. That sort of got me hooked back into storytelling. And even though my dissertation was still in architecture,
barns,
I had this sub-love then,
right,
for stories. And so that's how it all kind of connected up. And I went down to my first National Storytelling Festival with Ron Evans, where he, for the first time, was on the national stage.
That's fantastic. Sorry, I don't want to move on too fast, but what have you seen as the progression of business applications of storytelling? Once you started using it, was like what year? Around 2000?
That's when I started use it.
coming out of the closet as a storyteller?
Yeah, in a very explicit way.
Right. You had used it before.
Before then, what I was doing is a part of the organizational development work where a lot of change was happening in the organizations. I would go around and, you always do interviews.
Right.
Of people, and instead of doing the traditional interviews, I would collect stories and analyze the stories, and I could tell the health of the organization depending on the stories that I was collecting.
What was the specific mechanism you used to analyze the stories? Did you record them and then have them transcribed? Because that's something I've done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the practical aspects.
Practically, it depended on how much the client was willing to pay for. There are times when I was listening to stories and jotting down common themes. There were times I always recommended and wanted to record the stories and then transcribe them, and then I would analyze them and looking for common themes and common patterns.
Did you promise anonymity?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I always did too. I was just going to check that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that anything that was shared would be in bulk.
Right.
Where blended voices would emerge as opposed to individual voices.
Right.
And that seemed to relax people an awful lot.
So the feedback and story that you would give would be not just the positive cheer. It's just a complete diagnostic of the organization.
It is, absolutely. I would find broken stories where part of the original story has been lost and only a piece remains, and that might not be the piece that you want. Because I was working a lot on Wall Street with financial service companies.
Ooh, I bet there's a lot of broken stories there now.
Right. And that was part of the problem because the M&As were happening so fast.
Right.
That
for people who don't know, mergers and acquisitions.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the cultures were slamming together.
Right.
And stories were disintegrating as would be expected.
Right.
And so what was happening is that somebody with the whole story would leave, and another person who knew the story only knew maybe a piece of it, like an innovation that happened in the banking field. They would only know that a part of the story about how an ATM was created and not the full story. And so it lended itself to being so brief that it was almost not meaningful anymore.
Right. Is that kind of like, this is a story that my mentor told me, and we used it in self-awareness workshops, which is what I did for a really long time, that there's this woman who would always cut off the ends of the ham before she put it into the oven. And her husband one day asked, why do you do this? And she said, well, I don't know. My mother always did. So she went to her mother and said, why do you do this? I don't know. My grandmother always did. And it turned out that her grandmother had a very small oven and a very small pan. And the reason she had to cut off both ends is that it wouldn't fit otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was continuing to do something that didn't need to be done because circumstances have changed. Is that the sort of story that you're talking about?
Yes, also, and it reminded me about another story that is slightly different, that also illustrates a different kind of a way a story can be broken, where there was a Skunk Works group producing cutting-edge innovation within one of the organizations, and then as a result of the mergers and acquisitions, that piece no longer became valuable to the...
Right.
And so they were no longer funded and disbanded. But the problem was that the stories about their successes got completely lost.
Right.
They existed somewhere, but they had lost their voice in the organization.
And their identity and their value in many ways.
All kinds of things. And I do kind of put that in the broken story category.
Yeah,
it's more like a lost story, actually.
Not really. They're still there. And so the story is now they're useless, or you know what I mean. It's what did you do in that circumstance to repair that situation?
I would surface and tell those stories.
Right.
The other thing that I would happen is that two divisions had the same story but different parts of the story.
Uh-huh.
And so they, and neither division knew the other part of the story. They thought their story was what it was. And so I would bring both stories together to create the whole, and then reflect back that back to the organization. And what that did is helped with the divide of silos.
Well, with Territorial Games, which is my first book, and you and I have talked about before, is telling those two stories and making sure that each group understands the other person's story often just removes that silo, like you said. Just out of curiosity, when you surface those stories, I guess in the ideal situation, you had recorded the transcripts, and you did you get them to tell their own story to the other? Did you present to the leadership and then have that flow down? What's your preferred method to do this?
Well, it depends on what your objective is. Mm-hmm. If you're really trying to reduce silos, the division between silos, then the people sharing the stories back and forth to each other is the best way to do it.
Right.
If we're working on organizational change and trying to leverage our strengths, then taking that combined story and someone like me telling it to the executives is a good first step, because then they can tell that story themselves throughout the organization and filter that down.
Right.
So it kind of it depends.
That's
answer.
That's a good answer. Thanks.
But there are multiple ways to leverage a story. I think that's the main point.
Right.
There are multiple ways to leverage any kind of a story that you find in an organization, and the goal of the consultant is to find the highest leverage points and help the organization work with the story in whatever context they need to build strength.
I always think of that as a form of self-awareness, and you know, collaboratively, the collective self-awareness. Is that is that a good framework, or what's the framework that you use when you're thinking about it?
No, that is a very good framework. I like that a lot. I in my mind, the picture that comes to mind is shared and common understanding.
I wonder if shared and common understanding can happen without self-awareness. In some ways, they're the same thing, but shared and common understanding is group self-awareness, which is another level up. I think you have to have one before the other, but one by itself doesn't create the other. So anyway, that was Karen Dietz of JustStoryIt.com. Let's continue the conversation. I want to hear your thoughts about how she is using art to prompt storytelling, or any other thoughts that were stimulated by Karen's dialogue. You can record a message on our Story Factor podcast feedback line at 318-479-1077. Don't forget, I'm on Twitter. We can have a conversation that way, or you can email me at Annette@AnnetteSimmons.com. I'm very interested if you want to design your own storytelling training, if you're hoping to use storytelling in a retreat, and if you're interested in having me help personally, we can talk about that as well. You can call me on 318-861-9220, or again, just send me an email on AnnetteSimmons.com. Thanks for visiting with us on the Story Factor podcast, and goodbye until next time.